Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money. And hold that money. And practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never change anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
See, now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it don't come. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, she just took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Do you sometimes feel sorry for yourself? Sorry for yourself because of many responsibilities, many problems, many unpleasant situations? Don't worry. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Happiness, serenity, even a more satisfying life will come to you in greater degree as the load you carry grows weightier. The natural way to live is under a load. As soon as a baby can walk, he wants to carry something. Ever think of that? Sometimes you may pick up a load too heavy. May get him down, may fall on top of it. But he's happy. Even then, he has something to struggle with. Under your load, you are anchored and growing. You won't drift rudderless. A ship in ballast is an easy prey to winds and waves. A cargo gives her steadiness and aids the ship to safety, helps keep a true course. Likewise, the biggest handicap for a human being is moving through life with no steadying cargo. The young man with responsibilities will survive in shifting economic seas. Without a load, he's liable to sink. A man with no responsibilities flirts with doom. He'd better pick up a load at once. The workers survive. The shirkers often sink. Abraham Lincoln scaled the magnificent summits of greatness, carrying responsibilities too heavy for most men to bear. But Lincoln's heart and soul grew until they were capable of tremendous understanding. The burdens he carried only broadened his shoulders and deepened his great sympathies and tolerance for fellow men. Under his crushing load, he was yet able to lift up a bleeding nation and carry it to peace and safety. Had no burdens been thrust upon him, the great Lincoln might well have never have attained any greatness at all. Young and old are still lifted up by heavy, useful loads. Those who refuse responsibility may grow fat, but they lose the heights of greatness. They come crashing down to valleys of despair, smashed because they carried no load. A life with no burdens is an empty life, a useless life. But differently, those who disdain burdens during youth and middle age will ultimately bear burdens they never chose, despair, and the crushing burden of loneliness. The loads we try to avoid can often smash us. For responsibilities evaded in youth will come the regrets of old age. So when you next begin to feel sorry for yourself, to feel you bear more than your just share of burdens, stop, think, take inventories, be thankful that God has given you the strength and courage and ability to overcome whatever problem arises to confront you. If you have many responsibilities, you're much more fortunate than the man who has none. Don't waste time envying the other man. He deserves pity, not envy. Do you find life interesting, gratifying? Or are you unhappy because there seem to be many displeasing situations in your life? You don't know how to change them. Has it ever occurred to you that what now brings heartache and disappointment, disillusion, even disgust, may perhaps actually be the growing pains of eventual progress and attainment of what you want in life? Get the habit of looking at what now seems disheartening as unpleasant simply as a growing pain. Suddenly things won't appear nearly so difficult. It's amazing. Obstacles can be turned into opportunity. Tremendous opportunity for growth and for happiness. Don't you remember your growing pains of childhood? Don't you remember that finally someone told you those pains in the legs meant you were getting bigger? Yes. And you were. At that time, wasn't the objective of getting bigger your heart's desire? Remember how all at once then the growing pains stopped? And they did. That's part of life, too. Why must we take the growing pains of adult life so much more seriously than those of childhood? There's no reason for it. After all, if we take the attitude that we are stronger than any problem, that any situation contains its solution, it's tremendously effective to us. Our whole life is changed. Yes, the way to grow toward the light is like When Nature Wants a Man by Angela Morgan. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man. When nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part. When she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise. Watch her method, watch her ways. How she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects. How she hammers him and hurts him. And with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Yes, nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man, wake a man. When nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, and she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads, never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and in poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets the challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind. Could we understand her mind? Fools are they who call her blind. When his feet are torn and bleeding, and his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine. Yes, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. Yes, let me repeat some of this poem, which shows so clearly how important are the loads we bear, how necessary to the growth of our soul. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him to trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, as every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole. With what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned. Though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man, and fame a man, and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls the mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and finer. When the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. And every one of us is that man. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
And today on It's My House, our live stream is going to focus in on what the title is, Wealth Distinctions and Mount Rushmore Metrics. Wealth Distinctions and Mount Rushmore Metrics. Now, the metrics that we're talking about, we're using, we're going to give you 11 metrics today, 11 metrics based, and it comes down to, this is about money. This is about money and successful financial living and financial literacy. And that's what we call it, wealth distinctions. And we're going to take a look as one of our metrics. We're going to look at the founding fathers of the United States that signed the Declaration of Independence, throwing George Washington, the first president of the United States, too. We're going to take a look at their common denominators. And, matter of fact, the whole title is Wealth Metrics and Mount Rushmore Metrics, 1776 to 2022. Okay. We want to find some common denominators that work in 1776 and still work in 2022 and beyond, although it's still 2021 right now. So we have 11 metrics. If you're online, if you go to our Blog Talk page, It's My House podcast TV or Solar Landlord on It's My House, you'll see them listed there, and we're going to get to those in within a few minutes when we open back up the mic. right, today's podcast is titled Wealth Distinctions and the Mount Rushmore of Metrics when it comes to wealth distinctions, 1776 to 2022. Now, this is for people, this podcast is for people who are interested in becoming wealthy, regardless of economic climate. 619-768-2945 is the live stream call-in number. I'm going to name off 11 metrics, and we're in order to, in my opinion, to really study wealth, particularly here in the United States, you've got to take a look at, just as an example, they're not the only example, but it's a high-profile example. Founding fathers of the United States, the people that signed that Declaration of Independence. If you take, I believe that if you take a look at them on July 4, 1776, and then model as close as you can their lifestyle. It's 2021 right now, but the year's half over, so that's why I put it 1776 to 2022. It can go beyond that. I believe if you take a close look, the founding fathers who signed the Declaration of Independence and model what they did, which anybody can do, you can have wealth and financial success here in the 2020s and beyond. Here are the 11 metrics I have, and I'm going to pick a Mount Rushmore out of this 11. You might have a different Mount Rushmore, which, like I say, out of this 11, I'm going to narrow it down to what I think is the most four essentials. Population, and I'm going to name them off, and then I'm going to go through them one by one. Here are my metrics. Population, off the grid, no grid-tied appliances, zero government regulation, your profession, absence of ultra-high consumption, absence of state-sponsored education, social capital versus social services, sustainable lifestyles without banks, and absence of government agencies. Those are the 11 basic metrics that I'm using for this podcast. It's 2021 right now. Well, if you listen to this in 2022, it'll be 2022 and beyond. And we're going back to 1776 on this one. But these are common denominators that you can bridge the gap between time and space on this. All right, let's start with number one, population. The population of the United States on July 4, 1776 was 2,500,000. That's what it was for the, that's what the United States was. That was the population then. About 13 states from the 13 colonies. The largest city in the United States on July 4, 1776 was Philadelphia. 40,000 people. Okay. In 2019, Brooklyn, New York, which is just one borough out of New York City, and New York City is made out of five boroughs, Manhattan, Queens, Staten Island, Brooklyn, and Bronx. But the population of Brooklyn, New York alone in 2019 is 2,590,000 people. That's just one borough of New York City. But in 1776, the population of the United States was 2.5 million. That's it. Your largest city, Philadelphia, 40,000 people. So with the first metric of success, wealth and success, and I'm putting this all under financial literacy too, is live in a town that has no more than 40,000 people. Actually, I'm going to say 400 people. If all possible, live in a town that has 400 people or less, but at the extreme, no higher than 40,000 people. That's my first metric. Why? Because the larger the town, the more rules and regulations, and the more rules and regulations means it's harder to get ahead of the game. It's going to be more competitive. There'll be more regulation put into place, and typically with the way regulations run means, okay, it's not as easier, and it's not as easy to gain wealth. Second metric, off the grid. Every last one of the people that signed the Declaration of Independence by today's standard was off the grid. There was no electricity. I mean, it existed, but it didn't exist as we know it today. There was no such thing as a light bulb as we know it today. They couldn't go over to flick a light switch because light switches didn't exist back then. They didn't receive an electric bill from a localized, monopolized power company. There was no municipal water bill. There was no heating bill. Now, I mean, some people that are going to listen to this podcast or listening to this podcast, some people are paying on some type of utility bill year-round. Year-round. It's summertime now where I'm at, and the bills tend, if you got air conditioning and fans, your electric bill typically goes up, and your utility bill from the electric company, which is typically a monopoly in that town. Founding fathers that signed that Declaration of Independence. See, this has nothing to do with racism, because racism is not a factor in this. This is hardcore economics. None of them had an electric bill. None of them had a heating bill. None of them got a municipal water bill. There are people who have lost their homes and will lose their homes because they didn't pay their water bill, their municipal water bill. And you know what? I'm about to add on the 12th metric. I'm adding it on right now. I'm going to it. Okay, let me add it in right now. There we go. There's some people that have lost their homes because they couldn't pay their mortgage was paid off, but they couldn't pay the municipal water bill, so they lost their home to the city for not paying that municipal water bill. That leads me to the third metric. We got a total of 12 metrics right now. Zero property tax. There are people that are listening to this podcast that in all 50 states, their properties for sales by local governments because somebody didn't pay their property tax because they couldn't afford to pay them for whatever reason. You don't pay the property tax, then a local municipality can auction off your house, put the back taxes, and they can put you out of that house. The founding fathers did not have to pay property tax. Now, I'm saying this because some of these metrics you can find in the United States or around the globe, and it might not be zero, but there are plenty of localities in the United States and around the globe where there's zero property tax or very little property tax. In the United States, you probably can't escape property tax. But there are places in the United States where you can, where property taxes are like really, really low. Okay. So that's the next metric, zero property tax. The next property tax is no zero tide appliances. They didn't have washing machines, dryers, and things of that nature. Now, I've got a dryer, but it went out for whatever reason. I got a clothesline, and I dry my clothes outside. I know when I was over in Europe, year-round, we had access to a washing machine, but we dried the clothes inside the house, wintertime, outside in the yard, when the weather was nice. So no zero tide appliances. Next metric is no government-issued legal tender. On July 4th, 1776, there was no such thing as the United States dollar as we know it today. Legislation for the United States dollar did not come into play, and it's the legislation, mind you, until 16 years later after the Declaration of Independence was signed. They knew how to operate without cash. They knew how to trade. They knew how to barter. They had community scripts also, or community currencies. And you got people that live that way today. Most people that have money problems today have put themselves in a predicament due to, and we're going to get to this another metric on this. I may as well bring it up now. None of these people, to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, there was no such thing as state-sponsored education. State-sponsored education does not teach you anything about how to operate as the Founding Fathers did in a financial literacy point of view. Most of these people were educated through apprenticeships. They learned by doing. Shoemaking, planning, farming, blacksmithing, quite a few were lawyers. They learned through apprenticeships for the most part. Next metric, zero government regulation. There was no FBI, no DEA, no FDA, no FCC, no Department of Energy, no Department of Agriculture. And there were no government agencies as we know them today on the state and federal level, all with their hands out, because basically all your government agencies to a high degree are revenue collectors. Next metric, profession. Most of the people that signed the Declaration of Independence they were entrepreneurs. They weren't punch the clock 9-to-5ers. Next metric is the absence of ultra high consumption. Examples. The grocery store for most people that signed the Declaration of Independence, their grocery store for the most part was their backyard. They grew their food or they caught their food. I'm sure they had maybe some type of store, general store back then. However, there was no Whole Foods, no Walmarts, no shopping centers, no malls, which are essentially temples for ultra-high consumption. Next metric, absence of state education. I already went through that. Most of them were educated through apprenticeships. Next metric, social capital versus social services. Social services office didn't exist on July 4, 1776. These people, due to the fact that they did live in smaller communities, like I said, Philadelphia was the largest city back then, 40,000 people. Entire United States on July 4, 1776 was 2,500,000 people. Brooklyn, New York alone is 2,590,000 people. The New York City, all five boroughs, is over 8 million people, probably 9 million people. And the New York metropolitan area, just one metro area, is over 18 million. Back then, as well as you can do it still today, they relied on social capital. Social capital, being nice, being neighborly, was your primary currency. You got sick, you had a neighbor that can nurse you back. You needed something to eat, you had some neighbor that can feed you. You need a place to stay, a few neighbors can get together and build you a house. No bank loan, no government-sponsored insurance agency like FHA or VA or anything like that. Today, most people are socially bankrupt. Social capital versus, you know, to a very high degree, the founding fathers didn't even need cash. First thing, it was no cash like it is today, because like I said, that didn't come until 18 years later. The legislation came 16 years later. So they operated, they knew how to operate without cash. And you have people today that know how to do that. The Amish know how to do that to a high degree, and a lot of Mennonites too. They do have some cash, but, you know, it depends on the situation. The next metric is sustainable lifestyles without banks. Once again, now we can go back to 1590 on this one, when Ponce de Leon, the first white man, a European, to set foot on what we call now the United States in Florida. From 1590 to 1776, actually, we can go like, say, 16 years further than that. These people amassed great amount of wealth through social capital alone. Once again, the United States dollar, which is United States legal tender, did not exist back then. They built homes based on social capital. They built businesses based on social capital. The 12th metric is the absence, and I've repeated this throughout this whole thing, the absence of government agencies. The majority of your government agencies that exist today and the court systems that exist today, like the United States Bankruptcy Court, the 30-year FHA insurance-backed guarantee, the FHA mortgage, 30-year mortgage, is only like 64 years old. That's it. That's 12 metrics, and there are probably more. There are 12 metrics that I gave out that if you apply those 12 metrics today in 2021 or 2022 or beyond, those 12 metrics, you can get wealthy just like they did. Now, out of this 12 metrics, I'm going to name my Mount Rushmore. And I'm not basing it on the Mount Rushmore in the Dakotas. I'm basing it on financial literacy. If you take, now this is just my opinion, you can have your four Mount Rushmores, based on the founding fathers. Here are my Mount Rushmores. Population. Once again, the population on July 4th, 1776 was 2,500,000 people. I would say live in a town that has, for me, no more than 400 people. Most of these people lived in small towns. Some people consider a town of 40,000 people small, taking it down to 400. Sam Walton, the late Sam Walton, who became a billionaire, essentially, Bentonville, Arkansas, small town, man. But at the extreme highest, don't live in a town that has no more than 40,000 people. If you're in a town like New York, Boston, Chicago, L.A., San Diego, all those places, then it'll be easier if you go into cyberspace. But that's a whole nother podcast. Anyway, small towns, that's my number one metric. Because the larger the town, the more rules and regulations. And when you have more regulation, it's more difficult to become wealthy. So that's my number one pick for my Mount Rushmore of getting wealthy. Number two, the grid. Like I said, the common denominator with every last single one of the founding fathers who signed the Declaration of Independence, they were all off the grid by today's standards. None of them had indoor plumbing as we know it today. They had no flush toilets as we know it today. They didn't have no light bill. They didn't have no electric bill. They didn't have no water bill. And you got a lot of people that are going in rush hour today, twice a day, going to work, coming back from work, commuting. They're doing it because they got to pay that electric bill, water bill, light. They got to pay them bills. Those basic essential bills. And let's throw in Wi-Fi. Because I know when I'm a baby boomer. Parents were coming up, you know, starting out young and with the families and all that. They didn't have to pay no Wi-Fi bill or cable bill. So now you do have people today that are essentially off the grid or they reduced it. Like for me, I got to have Wi-Fi. Okay. But I know how to go solar. You know, I know how to harvest. Like, I'm on a well where I'm at. Where I'm living at right now, I ain't got no water bill. I got a well, and I got a reverse osmosis filtering system where I can drink the water, cook with it, and, you know, all that. So number two Mount Rushmore metric for me is get off the grid as much as possible. Number three of my Mount Rushmore, the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence, they didn't have no property tax bill. In the United States now, you got them. You basically can't escape it. You don't pay those property taxes, the local municipality is going to auction off your property and you're going to lose your house to tax foreclosure. Now, although you can't escape it totally like the founders of the Declaration of Independence did, you can get real close to that because there are plenty of areas around the United States. Most of these locations are rural, and there are plenty of them. There's an abundance of them all through the United States, but you got to go to rural areas to do it. I got 10 acres in one location. That 10 acres, and I paid the property tax bill late. I either paid for 10 acres now. I either paid $37.88 or $38.77, something like that. It was under $40 for 10 acres for the whole year, and I paid the bill late. It's in a rural location, and the comfort and conveniences of New York or Miami or L.A., Chicago, San Francisco, all those places. Yeah, no, the nearest Walmart's 3 hours away. But that's okay for me. No, there's no subway. There's no bus line. But I'm all right with that, too. I don't need the comfort and conveniences of a larger city. Give me the smaller tax bill. That way I can be sustainable. I don't want to be in a condo. And the condo fee, the monthly condo fee, is over $300 a month. No, thanks, but no thanks. I don't want a condo. Particularly at no $300, you know, a month condo fee. And we're not even getting into the mortgage. Because most people who have a condo, they have to pay the monthly mortgage, they have to pay the monthly condo fee, and the condo fee, although you might eventually pay off the condo, the mortgage, that condo fee never goes down. So I'd rather go out 45 minutes, an hour. Man, I'd rather be 3 hours away from the nearest Walmart, because I ain't got to worry about a roof over my head. I don't have to worry, you know what, if I get sick. Because you got people out there that can't even afford to get sick because of that condo fee. So that's my, let's see, population off the grid, zero property tax. All right, that's my third Mount Rushmore of wealth distinctions. For me now, yours might be different. And the fourth metric of Mount Rushmore for me, for financial sustainability, would be social capital. Because if you have enough social capital, you can tap in on friends and neighbors that can help you build. Who needs a bank? Just like the Amish and the Mennonites, and there are other people around the globe, where you can tap some of your friends and they can help you build that house and you don't have to get a mortgage. Most people who have mortgages don't have the social network of friends or family that can help them build a house. It'll be a debt-free house. That's why I play that non-friends video occasionally. You know, with the Latinos, dude went to work. You know, you work your 8 hours, and let's say half hour to work, half hour back. So let's say he was gone for like 9 hours. He came back in 9 hours, and the house that had been sitting there looking like a dump for all those years looked brand new. It's called social capital. That's my bank. I'd rather be rich in social capital, because that way I don't need Bank of America. And if you look at some of the wealthiest industrialists in the world, like I went over, I gave two of them last week, Honda. You know, they're public now, but if you look at their base, the origins of their wealth, it was built off social capital. And I get named a whole family last week. Generational wealth into the billions now. I remember before the end of this podcast, we did a podcast on them, Toyota. That's it, Toyota. The origins of Toyota were basically Honda started out of a shack and was built. The origins of it on social capital. Now they're in the billions, and then Toyota, which is still a family-based business. The great-grandson or the great-great-grandson of the founder of Toyota, still a family business, like four or five generations later, into the billions. The origins of it, social capital. I'll take social capital over a bank. I'll take social capital, because social capital is your bank. People who don't have a sustainable or Goodwill deposits in a social capital bank that's family and friends, those are the people that typically have to go to social services. And people that typically go to social services, not all, but most, are socially bankrupt. That's my Mount Rushmore out of the 12 distinctions that I just put in there. And racism has nothing to do with none of them, from my point of view. From my point of view, 12 metrics that the founding fathers had that we can duplicate in 2021 and beyond, 2022 and beyond. Like I said, the one that we'll have to make adjustments to, and once again, in my opinion, will be the property taxes. But look for rural locations where the property taxes are like really, really super low, and there's an abundance of them right here in the United States. If you got a Rushmore or a metric that you want to throw in, 619-768-2945, let's get the next audio.
Hi, I'm John Green. This is Crash Course U.S. History, and today we leave behind the world of industry and corporations to talk about the wild, wild west. Spoiler alert, you have died of dysentery. And in the process, we're going to explore how all of us, even those of us who are vegans or eat sustainably produced food, benefit from massive agribusiness that has its roots in the wild, wild west. The west still looms large in American mythology as the home of cowboys and gunslingers and houses of ill repute and freedom from pesky government interference, but in fact, it was probably not as wild as we've been told. Ugh, Mr. Green, why can't America live up to its myths just once? Because this is America, me from the past, home to Hollywood and Gatsby and Honey Boo Boo. We are literally in the myth-making business. So before the Hollywood Western, the myth of the frontier probably found its best expression in Frederick Jackson Turner's 1893 lecture, The Significance of the Frontier in American History. Turner argued that the West was responsible for key characteristics of American culture, beliefs in individualism, political democracy, and economic mobility. Like, for 18th and 19th century Americans, the Western frontier represented the opportunity to start over, and possibly to strike it rich by dint of one's own individual effort, even back when the West was like Ohio. In this mythology, the West was a magnet for restless young men who lit out for the uncorrupted, unoccupied, untamed territories to seek their fortune. But in reality, most Western settlers went not as individuals, but as members of a family or as part of an immigrant group. And they weren't filling up unoccupied space either, because most of that territory was home to American Indians. Also, in addition to Easterners and migrants from Europe, the West was settled by Chinese people and by Mexican migrant laborers and former slaves. Plus, there were plenty of Mexicans living there already who became Americans with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And the whole West as a place of rugged individualism and independence turns out to be an oversimplification. I mean, the federal government, after all, had to pass the law that spurred homesteading, then had to clear out American Indians already living there, and had to sponsor the railroads that allowed the West to grow in the first place. About as individualistic as the government buying Walden Pond for Henry David Thoreau. What's that? It's a state park now? The government owns it? Well, there you go. Now, railroads didn't create the desire to settle the West, but they did make it possible for people who wanted to live out West to do so for two reasons. First, without railroads, there would be no way to bring crops or other goods to market. I mean, I guess you could dig a canal across Kansas, but if you've ever been to Kansas, that is not a tantalizing proposition. Second, railroads made life in the West profitable and livable because they brought the goods that people needed, such as tools for planting and sowing, shoes for wearing, books for putting on your shelf and pretending to have read. Railroads allowed settlers to stay connected with the modernity that was becoming the hallmark of the industrialized world in the 19th century. Now, we saw last week that the federal government played a key role in financing the Transcontinental Railroad, but state governments got into the act too, often to their financial detriment. In fact, so many states nearly went bankrupt financing railroads that most states now have constitutional requirements that they balance their budgets. But perhaps the central way that the federal government supported the railroads and Western settlement and investment in general was by leading military expeditions against American Indians, rounding them up on ever smaller reservations and destroying their culture. Let's go to the thought bubble. There was an economic as well as a racial imperative to move the Native Americans off their land. White people wanted it. Initially, it was needed to set down railroad tracks and then for farming, but eventually it was also exploited for minerals like gold and iron and other stuff that makes industry work. I mean, would you really want a territory called the Badlands unless it had valuable minerals? Early Western settlement of the Oregon Trail kind did not result in huge conflicts with Native Americans, but by the 1850s, a steady stream of settlers kicked off increasingly bloody conflicts that lasted pretty much until 1890. Even though the fighting started before the Civil War, the end of the war between the states meant a new, more violent phase in the warring between American Indians and whites. General Philip H. Little Phil Sheridan set out to destroy the Indians' way of life, burning villages and killing their horses, and especially the buffalo that was the basis of the Plains tribe's existence. There were about 30 million buffalo in the U.S. in 1800. By 1886, the Smithsonian Institute had difficulty finding 25 good specimens. In addition to violent resistance, some Indians turned to a spiritual movement to try to preserve their traditional way of life. Around 1890, the Ghost Dance movement arose in and around South Dakota. Ghost dancers believed that if they gathered together to dance and engage in religious rituals, eventually the white man would disappear and the buffalo would return, and with them, the Indians' traditional customs. But even though a combined force of Sioux and Cheyenne warriors completely destroyed George Custer's force of 250 cavalrymen at Little Bighorn in 1876, and Geronimo took years to subdue in the Southwest, Western Native Americans were all defeated by 1890, and the majority were moved to reservations. Thanks, Thought Bubble. Boy, this Wild West episode sure is turning out to be loads of fun. It's just like the Will Smith movie. All right, Dan, this is about to get even more depressing, so let's look at, like, some pretty mountains and Western landscapes and stuff while I deliver this next bit. So in 1871, the U.S. government ended the treaty system that had, since the American Revolution, treated Native Americans as if they were nations. And then, with the Dawes Act of 1887, the lands set aside for the Indians were allotted to individual families rather than to tribes. Indians who, quote, adopted the habits of civilized life, which in this case meant becoming small-scale, individualistic Jeffersonian farmers, would be granted citizenship, and there were supposed to be some protections to prevent their land from falling out of Native American possession, but these protections were not particularly protective, and much of the Indian land was purchased either by white settlers or by speculators. After the passage of the Dawes Act, Indians lost 86 million of the 138 million acres of land in their possession.
Oh boy, it's time for the mystery document.
The rules here are simple.
I guess the author of the mystery document, and then you get to see me get shocked when I'm wrong.
All right. I have seen the great father chief, the next great chief, the commissioner chief, the law chief, and many other law chiefs, and they all say they are my friends and that I shall have justice, but while all their mouths talk right, I do not understand why nothing is done for my people. I have heard talk and talk, but nothing is done. Words do not pay for my dead people. They do not pay for my country now overrun by white men. They do not protect my father's grave. Good words will not give my people a home where they can live in peace and take care of themselves. I am tired of talk that comes to nothing. It makes my heart sick when I remember all the good words and all the broken promises.
I mean, that could be almost any American Indian leader.
This is totally unfair, Stan. All I really know about this is that the Great Father Chief is the president.
I mean, it could be any of a dozen people. How about if I say the name in 10 seconds, I don't get punished?
And start. Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Geronimo, Chief Bigfoot, Keokuk, Chief Oshkosh, Chief Joseph, Chief... Oh! Yes! Yes!
And now let us move from tragedy to tragedy. So if you're thinking that it couldn't get worse for the Native Americans, It did. After killing off the buffalo, taking their land, and forcing Indians onto reservations, the Bureau of Indian Affairs instituted a policy that amounted to cultural genocide. It set up boarding schools, the most famous of which was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where Indian children were forcefully removed from their families to be civilized. This meant teaching them English, taking away their clothes, their names, and their family connections. The idea, put succinctly, was to, quote, kill the Indian, save the man. Now, the U.S. wasn't the only nation busy subjugating its indigenous inhabitants and putting them on reservations in the late 19th century, like something similar was happening in South Africa, in Chile, and even to First Peoples in Canada. And you're usually so good, Canada, although the slower pace of Western settlement meant that there was much less bloodshed, so another point to Canada. And as bad as the American boarding school policy was, at least it was short-lived compared with Australia's policy of removing Aboriginal children from families and placing them with white foster families, which lasted until the 1970s. All right, Dan, we need to cheer this episode up. Let's talk about cowboys, the Marlboro Man riding the range, herding cows and smoking, solitary in the saddle, alone in his emphysema. Surely that is the actual West, the men and women, but mostly men, who stood apart from the industrializing country as the last of Jefferson's rugged individuals. But no. Once again, we have the railroad to thank for our image of the cowboy, like those massive cattle drives of millions of cows across open range Texas. Yeah, they ended at towns like Abilene and Wichita and Dodge City, because that's where the railheads were. Without railroads, cowboys would have just driven their cattle into endless circles, and without industrial meat processing, there wouldn't have been a market for all that beef. And it was a lot of beef, if you know what I'm talking about. I'm actually talking about beef. By the mid-1880s, the days of open-range ranching were coming to an end as ranchers began to enclose more and more land and set up their businesses closer to, you guessed it, railroad stations. There are also quite a few things about Western farming that just fly in the face of the mythical Jeffersonian yeoman farmer ideal. Firstly, this type of agricultural work was a family affair. Many women bore huge burdens on Western farms, as can be seen in this excerpt from a farm woman in Arizona. Get up, turn out my chickens, draw a pail of water, make a fire, put potatoes to cook, brush and sweep half inch of dust off floor, feed 3 litters of chickens, then mix biscuits, get breakfast, milk, besides work in the house, and this morning had to go half mile after calves. These family-run farms were increasingly oriented toward production of wheat and corn for national and even international markets rather than trying to eke out subsistence. Farmers in Kansas found themselves competing with farmers in Australia and Argentina, and this international competition pushed prices lower and lower. Secondly, the Great Plains, while remarkably productive agriculturally, wouldn't be nearly as good for producing crops without massive irrigation projects. Much of the water needed for plains agriculture comes from a massive underground lake, the Oglala Aquifer. Don't worry, by the way, the aquifer is fed by a magic and permanent H2O factory in the core of the earth that you can learn about in Hank's show, Crash Course Chemistry. What's that? It's going dry? My God, this is a depressing episode. Anyway, large-scale irrigation projects necessitate big capital investments, and therefore large, consolidated agricultural enterprises that start to look more like agribusiness than family farms. I mean, by 1900, California was home to giant commercial farms reliant on irrigation and chemical fertilizers. Some of them were owned not by families, but by big corporations like the Southern Pacific Railroad. And they were worked by migrant farm laborers from China, the Philippines, Japan, Mexico. As Henry George, a critic of late 19th century corporate capitalism, wrote, California is not a country of farms, but of plantations and estates. When studying American history, it's really easy to get caught up in the excitement of industrial capitalism with its robber barons and new technologies and fancy cities, because that world looks very familiar to us, probably because it's the one in which we live. After all, if I was running a farm like that Arizona woman I talked about earlier, there's no way I could be making these videos because I'd be chasing my calves. I don't even know what a litter of chickens is. Is it 4 chickens? 12? 6? It's probably 12, because eggs do come in dozens. The massive agricultural surplus contemporary farms create and the efficient transportation network that gets that surplus to me quickly makes everything else possible, from YouTube to Chevy Volt. And no matter who you are, you benefit from the products that result from that massive surplus. That's why we're watching YouTube right now. So agriculture and animal husbandry did change a lot in late 19th century America as we came to embrace the market-driven ethos that we either celebrate or decry these days. And in the end, the Wild West ends up looking a lot more like industrial capitalism than like a Larry McMurtry novel. The Wild West, like the rest of the industrialized world, was incentivized to increase productivity and was shaped by an increasingly international economic system. And it's worth remembering that even though we think of the Oregon Trail and the Wild West being part of the same thing, in fact, they were separated by the most important event in American history, the Civil War. I know that ain't the mythologizing you'll find in Tombstone, but it is true. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next week. Crash Course is produced and directed by Stan Muller. Our script supervisor is Meredith Danko. The associate producer of the show is Danica Johnson. The show is written by my high school history teacher, Raul Meyer, Rosianna Hals-Rojas, and myself. And our graphics team is Thought Cafe. Every week, there's a new caption for the Libertage. If you'd like to suggest one, you can do so in comments, where you can also ask questions about today's video that will be answered by our team of historians. Thanks for watching Crash Course. If you enjoy it, make sure you subscribe. And as we say in my hometown, don't forget to be awesome. Ah! Oh, I didn't get a good push.
Okay, today's podcast is titled Wealth Distinctions and Mount Rushmore of Metrics, and I've added two more metrics on to the 11 I have. I'm up to 13 metrics. And I'm basing this on the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776. I'm going from there to today, which is actually I'm going to the end to next year, which is 2022. The two metrics I added on was cheap labor. You got to factor in cheap labor. I didn't say slavery. I said cheap labor. Because today in 2021 and in 2022 and 100 years, 200 years from now, I've known some of these people, old pairs. Old pairs are typically, most of them are ladies. The ones I knew came from Europe. One was an old pair in France. The other old pair, actually I knew three. One was old pair in France. One was old pair in here in the United States. And one was old pair in Hong Kong. And the one I knew most, well, there's two I know kind of equal, the one in France as well as the one in here in the United States. You know, under her au pair contract, she had to take care of three kids, but she had a place to stay, didn't have to worry about food, had a car to drive. And they paid for her college. She was in a community college, paid for that. Now, it was less expensive for the people that she got employed by it was a win-win situation for the people who employed her, cheap labor, versus the au pair. Had she tried to go out and pay for all that stuff, she didn't have the income and wouldn't have made enough money to do it. Thus, so you have the au pair system that's around the globe. 200 years ago, it was probably called something else, indentured servitude or whatever. Now you have legitimate, in plain sight, au pair and au pair agencies. Cheap labor. Now, slavery was a form of cheap labor. Now, many people say that, they worked and they worked for free. Well, that's not necessarily true, because there were a number of, first thing, there were over 4,000 slaves who bought their freedom. In today's terminology, you can say they bought out their contract. There were 4,000 black folk that were former slaves that bought their freedom, and then in turn, they bought the freedom of other relatives. A number of them had their own plantation. One of the earlier ones, who I would call one of the architects of slavery, was a black man, Anthony Johnson. Look him up online. Cheap labor. So that's another one of my, and then you can still get cheap labor here in the United States and in other Western countries too. And I'm talking about legally now, because what we call slavery today, because George Washington had slaves, Thomas Jefferson had slaves, but it was all legal when they did it. And the slaves who bought their freedom and then in turn had their own slaves. Now, some of those slaves they had to buy were their own relatives. But in other cases, they weren't blood relatives. They weren't blood relations. But it was all legal. Maybe not by today's standard, but by those standards, but it was all cheap labor. The last metric, the 13th metric, and I'm bringing this up to 1938. I know it's 2021 right now, but the reason why I'm using 1938, because you know, a lot of people say, well, that was 1776. Well, 1938 is close to the date that we're at right now. 1938, and I can call this like the Dagwood Bumstead metric. If you watch the Blondie movies starring Penny Singleton and Arthur Lake, Dagwood Bumstead was the sole breadwinner of the family. In 1938, you know, they lived in a nice house, nice neighborhood, white picket fence. The Bumsteads, Dagwood and Blondie had two children, Alexander and Cookie, and they had the dogs and whatnot, Daisy and, you know, her pups. They didn't have a car, but they lived in a nice house. And Blondie was always, you know, dressed well. The kids were dressed well. So I'm using that 19 because for me personally, the houses back then, the average price of a house in 1938 here in the United States was about $5,000. I use that as my metric today. If I have to buy a house, I'm not paying no more than $5,000 to buy a house. Now, how can you do that in 2021 and 2020? You can buy them from banks. They're plate, like, if you go anywhere in the Rust Belt, you know, that's Detroit, Cleveland, the whole state of Ohio, the whole state of Indiana, New York, particularly Buffalo, Rochester, Niagara Falls, that neck of the woods, western Pennsylvania, and probably even eastern Pennsylvania, up in Philly, Camden, New Jersey, those places, Baltimore, Maryland, those places. You can find how there's about 30 cities in the United States, 30, 35 cities in the United States where you can buy a house. Now, granted, you're probably going to have to do some work to it. But you'd be surprised. Some of these houses, you really don't have to do any work. But, and I've bought my share of them, but they're houses that you can buy right now in the Rust Belt part of the United States for $5,000 or less. Granted, many of these houses are going to be in urbanized areas and rough neighborhoods. But they do it. But that's my standard. Now, if I had to build something, I'll build it for less than $5,000 and sell it for $5,000. But I don't go, for me personally, my personal metric, I stop at $5,000. There's a lot of people walking around with $5,000. But if you got to go out and get a mortgage and all that, no. So, let me readjust my my Mount Rushmore. I got to think about that. I'd have to toss one of my original four because I would. I think I'd have to stick that 1938 standard of the $5,000 house. You can still do, now you can't do it in Manhattan, New York. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in Washington, D.C. It's not going to happen in Miami, Florida, or Orlando, Florida. It's not going to happen in Los Angeles, California, San Diego. It's definitely not going to happen in Seattle, Washington, or San Francisco. But there are dozens of pockets throughout the United States, hundreds actually, if not thousands, where you can buy a house for $5,000 or less. If it's in the urban area, like a Detroit, a Cleveland, a Columbus, Ohio, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, those places, Buffalo, New York, Rochester, New York, and those places, urbanized areas where they, you know, you got the comfort and conveniences of, you know, your big stores, Walmart and CVS and all that other type of stuff. Granted, they're going to need work most of the time. You're going to have to put some money into them. Some of them, I've bought houses for as low in an urban area for as low as $500. The cheapest house that I had the opportunity to buy, now this is the purchase price. This does not include closing costs or fix-up. The cheapest price that I had the opportunity to purchase a house for, this is the purchase price, was $100. The closing cost probably would have cost me about two. But it had like $7,000 worth of liens on it. So, and that's what I'm looking at. The total pay-in, I didn't want to deal with that. But that would have been in the city environment. But I, you know what, I'd just rather build something on the low in a rural area and roll with it that way. So, and that's why a lot of people are doing mobile homes and RVs and things of that nature. Because the landscape of housing, you know, now you got people where home is their car by choice. They don't want to pay the condo fees, and the single family home, particularly in your larger cities, it's really more and more on a daily basis becoming more of a wealthy thing. And then you have the Generation Z people that, you know, they're saying, you know what, mom and dad and the grandparents, you know, Generation X and Generation, I mean, what do you call it, baby boomer generation? You know, man, I don't want a 30-year mortgage. You know, I don't want to, you know, forget about going to Harvard or Yale. I'll learn online, and I'll travel. I'll learn that way. And that's how you got a lot of, you know, 20-year-olds, and literally 2-0. I'm not talking about 25. You got people in their late teens that have been to practically, if not every country in the world, because they're not dealing with college loans. They're not dealing with that expensive apartment, and they're not getting a car loan. They're not getting a mortgage payment for 30 years, and they're living out of a backpack. If you haven't done so already, one of the things I highly recommend, I've done it four times so far, and I'm going to do it some more, is get yourself a backpack to a hostel and hook up with some other backpackers. I mean, you're going to meet some travel. Thanks to me, matter of fact, the very first time that I stayed at a hostel, it was up in Vermont. I met this guy. They were traveling the globe, and he told me about a place in Texas. And when I got back from, you know, this tiny house thing up in Vermont, I did some research on this place in Texas, and I bought. That's how I got the 10 acres. He told me essentially where to look. He told me where to look, and I found something in the next county open. That's how I got the 10 acres for $2,000. Just by hanging around some backpack. Them and truckers. If you don't have any trucker friends, get to know some truckers. Because they can tell you about stuff that you're not going to run across on the internet. Or at least where to look online. And anyway, those are my 13 wealth distinctions. And I got to figure out which one of my Mount Rushmore metrics to drop, because I added in on two. So I got 13 metrics. And I got to stick in, I don't know which one to drop, because I had to stick in my 1938 standard of living, the $5,000 house. I already know that I'm not going to live in Washington, D.C. or Boston, Massachusetts. The $5,000 house does not exist in those markets anymore. And for me, that's all right. I'll drive an hour or two. Now, if you're stuck on the city, you can go online. You can find a $5,000 house in Detroit, Michigan right now. They're there. But I don't recommend, first thing is, in my opinion, Detroit is not a place for beginners. Particularly if you don't live in Detroit. If you buy the $5,000 house, what is your game plan to get it fixed up? And you're going to have to think about security before you even think about buying it, because you're going to have a plan where you're going to have to do like those Latinos did. You're going to have to fix that house up within, in my opinion, a 24-hour period. No, actually, get everything done within a 16-hour period of time and move your people in. The people that you're going to move into the house, they need to move in at the conclusion of the 16 hours. Because Detroit's one of those places that if it's vacant and you put your brand-new hot water heater or your furnace in, if it's vacant, and let's say you fixed up everything. You started on a Friday afternoon. You finished sometime Sunday. Saturday. And then you say, all right, we're going to come back on Monday. If you left that hot water heater in and that furnace, by the time you come back Monday, that furnace and that hot water heater brand new might be gone. Detroit's that kind of place. I'm speaking from personal experience. So you can find a house for less than $5,000. And there are other towns like you can do it in Buffalo, New York, Rochester, New York, Niagara Falls, New York. You might still be able to do it in Baltimore, because Baltimore still got plenty of vacant houses. Indianapolis, then there are other cities in Indiana. Practically the whole state of Ohio, you can find cheap houses. Wisconsin, probably. I met somebody. She was living in California. She moved to Iowa because Iowa has a glut of cheap homes. Houses, that is. So there are places, all over where you can find cheap, but you need to know the lay of the land. Let's go to the phone lines here real quick. 336, your mic is open.
Grand Rising, Brother L.A.?
Yes, ma'am.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine.
Okay. You left, you disappeared on your show yesterday. That was a very powerful confirmation of what you played. The dad, Venus's dad, Serena, Venus's dad.
Oh, yeah, Ken Richard. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was so profound. It reminded me of my life. Him reminded me of some things. So I want that video so I can share with my children and my family. And I want to tell you, I got the old chemo by way of Dr. V, and I posted it on my page to the Crawford family. And if they come to your podcast, this podcast is dedicated to my family from Oklahoma, the Crawfords, the Vans, the Parises, and so on and so on. I posted that Laura Nelson video. And Mount Rushmore, that's interesting you do that today because today is a 7. If you add the digits up, I believe if I've added up right, that's spiritual. That's digging down to the rare things, investigating, and that's what you do, Brother L.A. That's what you do with the things that you bring to the table. And I'm grateful that I'm able to tune in. To chime in, the next thing, the last thing, I'd like for you to consider coming to Arizona backpacking in the Stronghold. It will mean a lot to a lot of people and yourself. So just put that in your peace pipe and drum smoke on it. I'm still in a care facility. I'm going today to the disease control doctor. I got myself off of these antibiotics that's killing the shit out of my body, and I refuse to take any more right now because I got things to do. I'm not out of the woods yet, family. However, I'm not giving up, and I give thanks to you, Brother L.A., for listening to you, your intuition. Now, that gospel song, why did you play that? At the beginning of your show. About
from
the
Move, Mountain Move.
Yes.
Oh, I heard that years ago on Kathy Hughes. Kathy Hughes is owns Radio 1 or TV 1. They're probably the largest minority owners of radio and TV in the country.
Mm-hmm.
She used to play that on occasionally on her morning show, the WOL morning show with Kathy Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 70s, man, or 80s.
Okay.
So I look at it as, morning motivation.
All right. Well, there's another one that I really would like for you to play. It's by the Mississippi Mass Choir. And it's I Ain't Tired Yet. I hope you can play that going
What's
out.
What's the name of it?
It's I Ain't Tired Yet, or I'm Not Tired Yet. And Mosey Burks, Mama Mosey Burks, is the lead singer. She's 88 now. She's still on the planet. She's in Mississippi. And I've been reaching out to her to see if I could get her mass choir group to help me do a resurrection at Miracle Valley, Arizona, which is where they had the shootout. In Harvey, Illinois, there's a church. And the sisters who have that church in Harvey, Illinois, their brother was blown up in a van out here 20 miles from where I live, and it's called the Miracle Valley Shootout. But what's so interesting about that, Jesse Jackson came out during that time to investigate, because they call it a literal a race riot. And it's a mm-hmm. lot of other things that has gone on. But that song was brought to me when I was doing my vision quest for 14 days there in the resting spot. And the resting spot, family, is a cemetery. and Brother Kwame can tell you, get you up to speed. I stayed out there in the cemetery for 14 days in 116-degree heat, which was very healing to my body. And that song was sent to me by way of Reverend Allen, Asa Allen, who created that Bible college there in Miracle Valley, Arizona, by another angel. Because when he came to bring me a hoagie sandwich, that was blasting on his radio. He said, Mama AZ, you need to have this song. And the day that he brought me that song was they gave her tribute, Mama Burke's tribute on her Earth Day, which was the 17th of June. And that's when that song showed up in my life. So if I ain't tired yet, by the Mississippi Mass Choir. I hope you can find it and play it on your way out today. But, however, reach at me, Brother L.A. Reach back at me because you have grown spiritually. That's why I ask you about that song. The other day when you said the universe has everything that you need or something like that, you don't know how correct you were, how on point you were, or maybe you did know. You're correct. And there's something else that's getting ready to happen, and I would love for you to be here in the stronghold.
There was a... Man, I forgot her name. You probably know it. It's somebody you know. A woman that she used to live in Baltimore, but she moved to Arizona. She bought a few acres out there. Well, you know what I'm talking about? I forgot her name.
No, sir, I don't. And by the way, this is Mama Bonfire AZ, and I'm calling you from Devon Gables here in Tucson, Arizona. And I love you. No, I don't know who bought the land, but I wish we could find out what I need.
I swear you, all right, you don't know her? Harry was a black woman. She used to live in Baltimore. I spoke to her like two times. I wanted to get on the podcast, never did. But she's originally from Baltimore. She bought a few acres in Tucson. I mean, not Tucson, Arizona. Somewhere in Arizona. I forgot the location. But I was just impressed. Man, somebody from Baltimore bought some land in Arizona. And
wait a minute, could you be talking about Sika?
Yeah, that's it. That's her name.
Okay,
you
now
you still in touch
me.
With her or have her number?
You need to call me, Brother L.A.
Yeah, I'll call you on that one. Yeah, she was originally from Baltimore, and see, that's where I look at a trend. Another one of my metrics. I didn't include it in today's 13 metrics. But another one of my metrics that, and I pick up a lot through YouTube. I think you're the one that told me about her. There are a lot of black women. I don't know what the percentage is, but there's a lot of single black women. Some are coupled up that are moving. Some are moving out of the country. You know.
Uh-huh.
For more sustainable and affordable living. But then those who are not moving out of the country are moving to other parts of the United States. For instance, I think places like Chicago, D.C., New York, Los Angeles, those places, even Detroit, I think those are the most toxic places for black people to live in the United States right now.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that are ahead of the curve are like this Seeker, the lady that you're talking about. She bought, I forgot how many acres she bought, but she moved from Baltimore to Arizona. And in Arizona, you can basically, if you buy right in the state of Arizona, you can put it this way. I consider various parts of Arizona the real United States of America. It's a totally different reality than you're going to get in a Chicago or a Baltimore.
Yes.
Totally different reality.
And it's
positive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not going to have the comfort and conveniences other Baltimore or Chicago or Detroit, but that's okay. You'll have the freedom.
Correct. And that is why, Brother L.A., you really must reach out to me because there are others off-world. When I say off-world family, there are others that are communicating from other dimensions through you. That's why your name is Davis. And one of those ascended elders is Napoleon Davis, who created that teepee. I want that to go on record on your show, Brother L.A.
I've covered him before. I'm going to cover him again. You know what? I got to do another show on him. And for people who are not familiar with Napoleon Davis, this guy built by himself, this is a structure that, in my opinion, is worthy of being on display in the Smithsonian some kind of way in D.C.
But you see, again, let me say this.
But hardly anybody knows about it.
Okay, because it's not meant for them to know about it. That's why we came along. That's why Chief Frank Foolsgrow, my dad, and other elders from Oklahoma guided me there. Even my husband in North Carolina has a part in this because the pains, if you notice in Laura Nelson's documentary, you'll hear the name Payne. Well, that Payne clan was responsible for me finding Napoleon Davis's teepee. Because somebody in that community, the last name Payne, was running for mayor. And I put two and two together. And see, they know that I pick up on stuff like this. So they present certain things to me so that I'll know which mile marker to pay attention to and where to go. You know what I'm saying? So you call. I'm done.
Yeah, I've been out to Napoleon Davis's.
Chicken enchiladas with beans and rice, egg salad sandwich, pinto bean soup.
Enchilada.
You want some mama bean soup?
Yes.
Okay.
That'll work. Yes.
And you know what? Every time I go out to Oklahoma, I except for the last time, I drove past it, but usually I go. I'm always the only one there when I go.
Well, Brother L.A.
But you know what? Some Mexican Americans. You know what? They might not even be American, but because I talked to them. Yeah, they got.
They have it. I have it on film.
The sin and the shame of it is. I spoke to a mayor in another black town, no more than 15-20 minutes away from that location, but it's in another county. But they didn't know nothing about that teepee.
Okay, there's a reason. There's also a reason why the Mexican people have it in their control, if they still do. My dad tells me about this. And there's a sister who traveled back from North Carolina with me. She has the Mexican and myself on film. See, they took all of that the schematics.
Yeah,
I
got it on film too. I took videos when I was out there.
Okay, well, the way that Napoleon Davis put that together, I know with the inch of my life that there were people from the Pleiades and all the star systems that guided him, Brother L.A., and how to put that teepee together like that. And I don't know why.
He was definitely inspired. You know what the shame of that whole thing is? He's got children that really should have taken control of that.
But no, they shouldn't, because they were not on his level. I'm learning even in my situation with my family. They had their own journey, Brother L.A. And they didn't. He was so beyond even his children. His children only came through him and their mother to get with the other people that they had an agreement with. That is why the ancestors took me there in dreams. And then I met this woman who was mayor of one of those townships, Joanne Fox. I told you this. Mm-hmm. She's connected to somebody in North Carolina who's also a mayor, a woman, in this little town in North Carolina. Well, that woman guided me to the street that had my husband's name on that sign. She guided me because I couldn't find it. And then something told me to get up and get in the truck and go back the same way. And then that's when I saw my husband, the Paines and other people, and the ancestor chief, Frank Fools Crow, and my dad told, and Chief Joseph told me to go up this road. I went up this road and I was told to stop at this house. The house that I stopped at on the corner, the man was named Robert Johnson, and he was a railroad conductor. I had dreamed about a train, okay? And he told me, he said, ma'am, you're here. I said, what you mean? He says, you're here. You go up this road, and there's Napoleon Davis's teepee. Now they have gotten.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's right. And the man.
And I've only been the only time I've been. Well, I've always gone with you know, Mayor Davis.
Right.
But typically, it's only us two there. That's it.
Is she still?
You don't see anybody else around there.
Okay, is she still rolling?
You know, I got to call her up. I haven't talked to her in a while, you know, since the pandemic started.
I wish you would, Brother L.A. You have no idea of what you have been sent historically, metaphysically, and so on and so forth. I'm serious, my brother. I have all of this on film and of my journeys. Because otherwise, people would think I'm full of shit. They wouldn't believe me.
Well, I've had that that what we call a TP. You know, actually, it's a monument built like a TP.
Yes.
But it's amazing that, like, see, every time I've been there, there's been you see no other human around that place, and you got to know exactly where it's at, but it's a monument, and this is amazing. He built that thing all by himself.
Well, you see, brother L.A., that's why I was allowed to be there. Nobody was there, and I cleaned the place up. I cleaned it up inside. I stayed there on the weekend a couple of days to get the feel of it. Even when I was there.
You know, nobody will bother you up there. You know what? You can probably camp out there and nobody would even know.
That's what I did. That's exactly what I did. And another thing, Brother L.A., you again are Davis, and you really must pay attention to that. You really must pay attention to that. I want to ask you, what do the numbers add up for today? Today is the 3rd, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
now, I don't know anything about numerology now.
Okay, wait. Listen to me, Brother L.A. Just add it up. It's 2021, which is a 5. And then today is the 3rd, okay? So... And it's the 8th month, 8, 9, 10, 11. And then you add the year, which comes to a 5. What do you get?
You tell me.
You
did you have
7.
One of those up twice? What's the number you have? You come up with?
Okay. Add this. Just do it with your eyeballs. Today is it's the 8th month. It's August.
Yeah.
It's 8, 3, 2021. Family, add that up and see what you come up with.
All right, 2021. That's 5.
Add them all. Right.
Okay. 5 plus 3, which is today's date, that's 11.
correct?
And what else are the other numbers?
This is the eighth month.
Did we add that already?
I don't know.
All right, 8 and 3. All right, 8. Hold it. 8 and 3 is 11.
That's right. And then you
okay.
put the 5 to it.
All right, that's 16.
And what's 1 and 6?
7.
Today is a 7. And that gives me another explanation as to Napoleon Davis is rolling in this camp, in your camp. What are the odds of me rolling through there and tell you about it, and then you go and purchase some land there?
Well, you're right about that, because that monument, which is dedicated to Creek Freeman, I had to have somebody who knew the area that knew where to go, because you just don't drive by this place. You got to know what area to go, because it's all rural. And you got to go this road, and then you'll see it pop up.
That's right. Well, I have to listen to my instinct.
Well, you know who grew up. Now, that location is not in Taft. It's in Muskogee, but it's not in Taft proper.
Right.
But it's a graveyard. Sarah Rector, you know what? It's all Muskogee County. So, in addition to that, Sarah Rector, Sarah Rector's childhood house is still in Taft, Oklahoma. Somebody lives in it.
Wow.
And then
wow.
Also in Muskogee County was, what's his name? Joseph Jake Simmons Jr., who was probably, when he was living, the wealthiest black man and one of the wealthiest people in the United States.
Wow.
All of that in Muskogee County.
Okay, now may I say this? This is to my cousin who just moved to Paiute Country. That's Las Vegas. Paiute, the Paiute tribe is Wavoka, who was a medicine man who brought the ghost dance shirt theme back. Have to research it. Well, John Jr., I told you before that your people, your dad, Sonny Man, I call him, John Crawford, he knows about the land there, John Jr., and you really must research, because your people, my people, have land there. And I'm speaking to you from It's My House on Brother L.A.'s show, who's based out of Florida. All right, this is Robbie. This is your cousin Robbie talking to you on this podcast. You need to pay attention, babies, because we have land there in Oklahoma. I can't research it. I'm too old. However, you got some years on you, and this goes to the Parrish family and the Crawford family and also Laura Nelson's family. Thank us, Brother
There's
Elliot.
A lot of it out there.
Yes, yes, yes.
There's a
so,
lot of it. Not only Oklahoma, but all, I mean, Arizona's got a lot of there's a lot of land available all through the, actually globally there's a lot of land available. It's just a matter of, for those that, willing to deal
well,
with. Some people I know, you're not going to pull them out of a city environment. That's just it. I think the absolutely worst cities for African Americans in the United States or where you find the largest concentration, like Chicago, Boston, D.C., yes, Deegan, I got a house in D.C., Baltimore, Los Angeles, I think blacks need to start moving out of those major cities and going rural.
Right.
That's crazy L.A. speaking, because the less population, the rest, it's just, like I say, you'll find what I call the real United States outside of these densely populated, I would say that if, even if a person's white.
Yes.
Cities are not where it's at. Not the big
mm-hmm.
ones.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's got a different situation. So,
yes.
All right, but I'll get to you, Mom AZ, on that.
Thank God.
Let's take another caller.
I'm going to mute.
Go ahead. Let me 314, your mic is open.
Hey, L.A., what's going on, man?
Oh.
Is that Brother Pianchi?
Yeah, that's me.
Greetings, Brother Pianchi. I'm going to mute. Thank you, Brother L.A. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
You say that black people need to move up. They need to stay in them cities with their democratic liberal ways. Because when they move into them rural areas, coming down into them red states, they bring that old fail, ratchet politics with them. Then,
now, you do have a very good
time,
point. You had a very
there
good
goes
point.
The neighborhood.
Because the mindset... The mindset of somebody that might look, since I'm from D.C., I'm going to pick on D.C. The D.C. mindset that a lot of people have in D.C., and like I was born in D.C., still got a house in D.C., the ratchet mindset that a lot of them have, not all, it ain't going to work in a rural area. You're absolutely right.
No, it ruins it.
It's not going to work.
It's the same way. You know blacks flee, right? They flee areas, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got white flight. Nobody talks about black flight. Well, blacks flight, blacks flee other blacks that move into their neighborhoods, into their area, because of the behavior, attitude, the way they react, the way they vote, so blacks will flee. And you know, here's the thing too:
that's
some blacks that have to flee. Yeah, them blacks that have to flee is losing money because they have to run and lose money in their property. Somebody need to be paying their reparations.
Well, that's a whole nother.
Think about it. Think about it. Look at Ferguson. Blacks
mm-hmm.
had lived in Ferguson since the 60s, escaping crime in North St. Louis. Then all of a sudden around 2014, leading up to that, they started moving out into the Ferguson area.
Mm-hmm.
There between West Lawson and Frostwood Park, they had some townhouses they turned into low income. Then you got Canfield Drive, low income. Then other areas. Next thing you know, there go the property value. Well, then the schools. Well, the blacks that have been living there that had sustained the property and had residual wealth in their property, they couldn't get that out. They had to walk away from it. So somebody need to pay them reparation because of the politics that put those blacks out in those areas. There's no way in the world that they can sustain, causing others to lose value in their investment in their home.
You done put a new spin on reparations.
And the schools went down. The children could get educated properly because now you got somebody in the classroom. And, you know, I ain't blame the kids. But they bring their homely habits to the classroom. If you don't have respect for authority in the house, you're surely not going to have it in the schools. You get the fighting of teachers, disruption, the grades go down. Then it further hurts the neighborhood because...
that's true. Matter of fact, we need to bring Warren Houston on here maybe tomorrow to speak on that, because I used to be in the D.C. school system, man. I had to park my car two or three blocks away from the school.
They'd tear it up.
Yeah, they'd tear it up. And then at lunchtime, I moved it again to another location. I didn't let it sit in one spot all day. But I didn't park it on the school parking lot.
Well, see, here's the thing. When you got ratchet schools, nobody's going to move in the community. Thus, the property values go down further. So those poor blacks that have been living in those areas have been built up assets in their property. They lost it. They had to walk away from it. And the politics, the Democratic politics that inspired it, they need to pay them people reparations for the loss of their property, for the experiencing of the crime, break-ins, burglaries, robberies, and so on and so on and so on. The mental grief.
You done put a whole new spin on reparations just with that.
And I wish Warren would have a class on teaching people how to file civil suit. Because when you have one of these idiots tear up your property and your cars, hit and run, or when they do other notorious things to you, like tearing up your burglarizing your home, and you go to court against them, and the judge is going to let them go, you need to file civil suits against them.
You know,
because
what?
If they ever did get reparations, you could get it from them.
I'm going to contact Warren today and see if I can get him on tomorrow for that, because that's a very good topic. I'm thinking what my landlord had on. A lot of people get caught up with people tearing up their property, but they don't do anything. They don't put them in civil court.
That's right. They need to take them to civil court. Let me ask you a question. What do you think about George Floyd? Do you think that George Floyd's past should have been brought out against him? I mean, just your opinion. You don't have to get into detail.
In my opinion, I don't think his past mattered. Now, my opinion.
All right, let me ask you a question. Well, if that's the case, and many people say that, especially these talking voices, why in the hell did Sonny Liston's past haunt him? The NAACP said that Floyd Patterson, which was their flower boy, the perfect pitcher, the male Rosa Parks, had no criminal, that he shouldn't fight Sonny Liston because of his criminal past and associations. That's what I'm talking about. These NAACP types and these other core and the other ones did not want Sonny Listens to fight Floyd Patterson because of his association, quote unquote, with mobsters. And that he has been involved in strong arm robberies in the past. He wasn't the picture of the model black person.
Well, that's the same
what
thing
they
with Rosa
called
Parks.
Sonny Liston. Huh?
Yeah, Rosa Parks wasn't the first, Claudette Colvin. But she was, 16 and pregnant by a married man. So the architect.
And Claudette also.
Right, yeah.
So if they don't think that people, conservatives, say that they don't want a criminal like George Floyd to be a representative of them, and people want to say, oh, his past had nothing to do with it. Well, Sonny Liston's past had something to do with it, and Claudette's past had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Them damn chysters. Anyway, you about
ready?
Yeah,
you're right.
I don't stir
okay,
up enough.
Okay, Bianca. Well, I'm gonna call contact Warren and see if I'm getting him in tomorrow on the civil law side. On that note, everyone,
right,
have a good rest of the day.